So I would ask, there you go. So I would ask counsel for the appellant to begin again and then have the marshal start the clock. Thank you.
Yeah, and I'll just keep a close eye on Judge Cochran in case that happens again, and maybe the marshal could do the same. I was really just at the beginning of just kind of saying thanks to everybody for being here and admitting that at the point of filing out, filling out the statement of the case and notice of appeal, that I had a temptation to not request oral argument. It was for probably only a split second where I had that temptation. I don't ever want to pass up the opportunity to not only reiterate some of the arguments that I've made at the district court level, but also hopefully be able to answer any questions that the panel has. So I think with that said, I'll probably just start making my arguments that maybe the panel's already somewhat familiar with, but nonetheless, I'll go through them again. There's kind of, I guess, three arguments. One is an evidentiary issue. The second one is whether reasonable efforts were provided in this case. And then lastly is whether it was in the best interest of the child to terminate mother's parental rights. And so I'll start out with the evidentiary issue. respondent sought to admit into evidence pursuant to the hearsay exception, the business records exception, a number of chronologies, and for the court's benefit, I don't want to assume everybody's aware of what those are, but those are basically notes that have been taken by the respondent's agents, agents of DHS that have tried their best to simultaneously record kind of things that have happened throughout this case. And I have basically two arguments opposing the admissibility of those records. And I think the one that's to me most clear and I believe dispositive is that there was no testimony from a custodian or other qualified witness.
Bruno, I'm going to stop you again.
It just happened, it looks like.
It looks like Judge Cochran can't hear. And Judge Cochran, can you just say something so that we can make sure you can speak?
Yes, thank you, Judge Conley. And I will try and use the raise my hand feature if I have a question.
Great. Then I think based on that, we will continue with the arguments since Judge Cochran can both hear and we can hear her. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
Mr. Troyan, I'm going to stop you since we're at a little pause anyway and ask, yeah. You know, I understand your concern about sort of the lack of laying the foundation that we generally require under the rules of evidence. But how did the admission of this log, these notes, prejudice your client?
Well, that's actually something that I would probably be getting to. I don't know that it actually does. And I was kind of maybe going to make that point in that it's in some ways, I think they actually really help my client. They go to the issues of reasonable efforts and best interests, which are kind of my main basis for opposing the termination of parental rights. So it's a very good and fair question. I probably have to say that my issue with this business record exception is this is not an unusual thing to be confronting in these cases. And I don't think we have a lot of direction from the Court of Appeals on, or the Supreme Court for that matter, on this rule as it applies to child protection cases. And so it's maybe a little bit of an opportunity for me to share that with the court. but I don't know that I don't know that it's that the records themselves determine the outcome of the case. I'll put it that way. And so I hope that answered the question. And just where I was kind of leaving off at is that there is a requirement in the rule that a custodian or other qualified witness essentially talks, lays testimony that I won't read verbatim all of the things, but essentially the things that are required to at least show that this is in fact a business record. And we don't have that in this case. And I think if nothing else, it's important to make the courts aware that that's something that needs to happen.
And so I agree with you. I am on the Rules of Evidence Committee, so I think this was error. But since you've admitted there might not be prejudice, perhaps you want to go on to your two other issues, which I think are more important.
I agree. And one last point I did want to make, though, on this rule that, again, I think the courts could help clarify whether it's in this case or in the future, is whether these notes are prepared for litigation. And I'll maybe just leave it at that. But I mean, these are notes from the petitioner. They're being petitioner at the district court level, respondent here, and their agents, and they're prepared as part of an open case in the court system. So I'll just leave that at that point. Moving on to the reasonable efforts and best interest things, issues, I should say. So again, I'm sure the panel is very used to hearing standards of review and standards of proof. And I don't want to overlook the importance of that, especially in this case, that there has to be clear and convincing evidence. And as the courts have talked about in their review of these, it's substantial evidence is what's required. And so with the issue of reasonable efforts, I'll just start off with what I think is the most compelling fact that is undisputed. The mother in this case did not have an ongoing social worker from the end of August to the end of December. The agency is required to provide reasonable efforts unless they are relieved of that. And Judge Bjorkman, I see that you have unmuted.
I have a couple of questions. First of all, do you contend that finding of fact 31, which lays out all of the services and programs that were provided, do you contend that that's clearly erroneous?
I would contend that's a vague finding of fact. It talks about since 2017. And so there's a lot of things that could have happened from 2017 to March of 2020 that I would argue are pretty much irrelevant to the issue of when this termination of parental rights petition was filed in June of 2020. And so the finding of fact that I focus on is 32, which starts talking about March of 2020. And that should have subparagraph after subparagraph of everything that the county had been doing to provide mother with services.
But what can you tell one more question? What are an agency's obligation when a parent has said, I would like to be relieved of my parental rights? I want to give them up. I mean, I think that's what mother said in March of 2020. You're suggesting the agency, notwithstanding a parent's expression of wanting to assist in transferring custody or, giving up, relinquishing parental rights, nonetheless has a duty to offer services?
Yes, Your Honor. So couple things on that. Number one, I don't think that her verbatim statements in March of 2020 that she says something about, wanting to give up her rights. I don't think that should be equated to wanting to terminate her parental rights. She made those statements without, at that time, any advice of counsel. I think there's some layman terms. She was under the impression that she was going to be entering into essentially a shared parenting type arrangement at that time. She had two children who were already in that foster home, and it was kind of the expectation that the third would go there. And that's what I think the court has to give her the benefit of saying, that her intention was to move towards permanency in that matter. Secondly, I think it's very important to note that changed course. That changed course in the end of June. And so that's a significant development in this case, that instead of going from what she thought was going to be best for her child to have, still be part of that child's life, but to be in a stable environment with a different family, now she's going to be in a total, potentially random home, which is what it's at right now.
Mr. Truen, I had one question following up on Judge Bjorkman's excellent question. At one point, mother testified that she does not need any help from the county and she needs the county to get out of my life. My first question is, was that testimony at trial?
You are putting me on the spot to not know 100% whether that was stated at trial. I think a fair summary of the testimony at trial was that she felt like the services the county was providing were not helping.
At any time, does the record indicate that she expressed that opinion to anyone?
I do believe it does. I believe if the court reviews the social service notes and through different testimony, and I still did kind of want to wrap up my point with Judge Bjorkman too, in terms of, you know, what is the agency's responsibilities, and I just have to say it, the responsibility, if they believe the parent is not going to engage in services, then you don't do a facade case plan and just act like, well, we've done this case plan and whether no one's going to really take it seriously and we're not really going to follow up on these services. No, you go to the judge and you ask to be relieved of reasonable efforts. That's the proper way to do this. And unless they've been relieved of that, they do have that obligation. It's not uncommon, I don't think, for parents to feel discouraged, make comments that they maybe don't want to do something, and then to move forward in the timeline, again, with the development of the case. So then you're talking in the end of June, now this shifts to a termination of parental rights, and the only social worker that she had was on board from the end. At that point, my point would be on this is that's the final 6 months of the case, starting once the termination, it's almost 6 months to the day from the day the termination of parental rights was filed to when the final day of trial occurred. And for four of those 6 months, she did not have a social worker. That's a problem.
So this is Judge Cochran, just following up on the questions from Judge Bjorkman and Judge Conley. So is it correct to say then you're not challenging the district court's finding in paragraph 35 that mother indicated no willingness to work with the agency and work a case plan? She just plainly wants nothing to do with ICHHS.
I apologize. I'm looking for...
That's at the end of that finding in paragraph 35. But I guess sure. More generally, are you challenging the district court's finding that she indicated a willingness or no willingness to work with the agency? And no, if so, on what basis?
No, I'm not. I'm just challenging that somehow relinquishes the agency from having to engage with a parent in services. They still have an obligation until they've been relieved from the district court of those efforts to attempt to work with a parent. So the problem here, and again, thinking about burden of proof, we don't know what mother would have done from an end of August to the end of December. Things had changed in terms of potential relatives not really working out. She had housing, and without those reasonable efforts being provided, we can't say what would have happened in those 4 months. And framing it in terms of burden of proof, I think that's a very big problem. There is a mechanism in place for the agency to request to be relieved of reunification efforts. It's pretty clearly in the statutes. It's something that can be contested if that's what they seek to do. That's the way that this should be done in every case, not to just ignore a case plan and ignore a statutory obligation. We're talking about significant liberty, fundamental rights here. I think the U.S. Supreme Court has kind of described it as the most fundamental right. And to just kind of gloss over those requirements that they engage with a parent to just say, well, the parent says they don't want to do it, so we're just not going to do it. No, that's not how it works. They have to do it until they've been told they don't have to do it. That's the bottom line. So I see we're getting close to the end of my 15 minutes. I'm glad we spent most of the time so far on this reasonable efforts issue, because I do think it's the most important one. I think the best interest standard is difficult given the standard of review. But I would point to and this applies as well to the reasonable efforts issue, looking at, again, this substantial evidence, the county called basically two witnesses in support of their petition. The social worker who was involved from basically May to August. And the guardian ad litem, who had already made up her mind on a termination of parental rights in March. And there's no testimony from the other social workers that have been involved with this family, no testimony from a therapist, no even, you know, really no notes from therapists. And there's a lot that's missing, in my opinion, when we're looking at this substantial evidence requirement. To have only one social worker, one agent of the petitioner testify, and that person no longer is even employed and has been somewhat minimally involved with the family, given the history, I think that substantial evidence issue plays in, number one, with that's probably my strongest argument in support of the best interest issue. But I think that's even more important for the reasonable efforts issue as well, is just why doesn't the court now on review or even at the district court level have more information? I see that my time is up, so I apologize for going a little over.
You, and you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
May I please the court, counsel? My name is Rachel Evenson. I am an assistant Itasca County attorney, and I represent the respondent, Itasca County Health and Human Services. And I'd just like to make sure that you can hear me. And I did notice that Judge Cochran, can she still hear? And there's her video back. Okay.
I can still hear. I just switched to my laptop. It appears that can you see me now?
Yes.
It appears that my web camera stopped working. I'm having this morning has been challenging in terms of technology for me, so I apologize, but I will. I think this should work now.
Thank you, and thank you for working through it. I think that's one thing that the pandemic has really taught everyone, is to be so creative and try to, and flexible with working different options.
The marshal is going to restart the clock so that we give you your full time. Go right ahead, counsel.
Thank you. Would you like me to restate my name for the record then? Or
No, I think we got
it. It's recorded. Okay. So I would just like to clarify a couple of things. In the record, I don't believe that there is any reflection that mother ever said to the agency that the services weren't helpful and that she needed something else. And also, social worker Gens was with the agency till the end of September, early October. So she had worked with the family. She had worked with this family since 2019, initially with the oldest son, and then transitioning to take over the case for the younger girls when another social worker had gone on parental leave. She was very familiar with the case, well aware of what was going on, and she sought to work with mother throughout the summer to find workable solutions to some of the issues that were coming up with this very liberal parenting time that were causing issues with the foster family. And then when she left the agency, a supervisor at the agency took over. And because her involvement was limited to those, basically the time of trial, there wasn't a lot of additional that she had to testify to. But between the two trial dates, a social worker reached out. Mother admitted that the social worker reached out and offered her things like a gas card to get to the courthouse to use the iPad.
Ms. Evenson, I wanted to ask one question following up on counsel for the appellant's point that the guardian ad litem had sort of made up her mind from day one. Does the record indicate, since that initial assessment by the guardian, that the guardian had visited with mom from March of 2020 prior to the trial before forming her opinion?
Yes, between March of 2020 and the trial, the guardian had met with mother and had spoke. The guardian throughout her testimony said that in any correspondence with mother, she was under the impression that mother was not a permanency option. And that was part of how she made her decision about what would be in the best interest for the child. And I'd like to just pivot to this idea of a shared custody arrangement.
Let me ask, I just want to make sure I understand what you just said, Ms. Evenson. You're saying the guardian liam, relying, I guess, on the fact that this case came back into court on a petition to transfer custody with mom on board for the custody, but it changed in June when the foster parents said this isn't going to be a permanent placement. And at that point, a TPR petition is filed. It seems to me the guardian ad litem at that point had an obligation to evaluate the child's best interests as to whether TPR was in fact in the child's best interest.
Yes, and I can note that the guardian ad litem was involved in the process, and at the beginning there was an alternative or a competing permanency petition with a potential placement with a relative in Washington that would have been another transfer to that relative in Washington. And the guardian ad litem was involved with researching that potential option. She was on a phone call with that relative in Washington. So I don't think that it shows that she had made up her mind as early as March that TPR was the only way to go. And then I'd like to touch on this idea of a shared custody arrangement. Minnesota law there isn't a permanency disposition that allows a parent to come to the agency and say, I'd like to co-parent with you, agency. And that was in part, maybe mother was under some, or appellant was under some mistaken idea of what was available as a permanency disposition. But there were no other permanency options that existed by the time that we reached the termination of parental rights trial. And throughout the time that these other permanency options were being investigated and the termination petition had been filed, mother never asked to have the child returned to her care. Not until the second day of trial did she say that she could be 100% of the time parent. At the first day of trial, she said she was at a place in her life where she just needed to take a back seat. She needed to be that backseat parent. And the other thing is that the court made specific findings about how that very liberal contact affected the child's behaviors and noted that the child's negative behaviors were directly commensurate with the amount of contact. And contact is usually at the discretion of a foster parent or an adoptive placement, because this can happen where children can become very confused about who is the parent, who's in charge, who's setting the rules. And if there are competing rules, which rules apply when? Appellant's behaviors reduce the chances that any foster family could navigate that contact issue that derailed the transfer a permanent custody arrangement to the first identified foster family. And the child's confusion was a legitimate concern of the guardian ad litem throughout the case, and a legitimate concern of the court that comes out in a number of the findings in the order. So
I'd like to go back to the reasonable efforts question. I think you responded in part to appellant's argument, but can you identify for us, what's your best argument that the county did make reasonable efforts after that social worker left the position?
Yes, and leading up to that time, social worker Gens had been working very hard with the family to facilitate visitation, trying at one point to get to a supervised visitation schedule, having struggles with getting releases signed. When she left and the case transitioned to the supervisor continued to work with mother to ensure that she knew of the court dates that were upcoming to facilitate the visitation after there had been a change in placement, worked on facilitating the visitation between the siblings after the youngest daughter had moved to a different community, and followed up with ensuring that the previous social worker's attempts to transfer therapist to the new community happened, and also just that mother had what she needed to be able to get to the trial.
Ms. Stevenson, I'd like to follow up on Judge Cochran's excellent question. Was there ever a time when appellants the appellant expressed, you know, something to the child protection workers that, like, you know what, I've changed my mind now, I want to get with the program, help me. Does the record indicate that ever happened?
No, the record does not indicate that happened. And then I would just go to that the trial court was correct. The trial court, the question is, did the trial court commit clear error? And I think the answer is no. And also the trial court did not abuse its discretion. The trial court did what was required by law. It weighed the evidence, applied the law to the evidence, the facts, and reached a decision. And there was substantial and sufficient evidence to support the finding that clear and convincing evidence supported the termination of appellant's parental rights pursuant to 260C 301 subdivision 1B2, which is the refusal and neglect to comply with the parent-child relationship after those reasonable efforts have been offered. And the second basis was that clear and convincing evidence supported the termination of appellant's parental rights pursuant to subdivision 1B5 of the same statute.
Ms. Evenson, I'd like to have you comment on the evidentiary argument directly. And that is, what foundation was laid by the county at trial to admit the social worker's notes and the inventory log?
And Your Honor, there was not a lot of foundation that was laid. The court had admitted those documents after ruling on the objection and upholding parts of the objection that parts of the record related to the oldest son were not going to come in, and also any duplications were not going to come in, but that those were admissible.
But that's more a relevancy determination than an admissibility foundational decision, correct? I mean, do you acknowledge that this wasn't the right way to determine whether the business records exception to the hearsay rule applied?
I do acknowledge that. And the other thing that I would just fall back on would be the judicial notice of the underlying CHIPS matter and the records that came in through that underlying CHIPS that detailed all of the reasonable efforts that had been offered in the prior CHIPS matter, and that the agency involvement with the family had gone back to 2013, sometimes on voluntary basis, other times through that CHIPS matter that lasted for about a year. And then I would just note that the court said it very well in the conclusion of law, talking to the best interest of the child, in saying that her competing interest was the most important thing, and that was the need for stable, nurturing home where consistency was the norm and could be provided and is being provided, and her mental health needs are being met and can be met and made a priority. And with that, I would rest on my written submission and waive the additional time unless there are any other questions.
Seeing none, we will go to counsel for the appellant for rebuttal.
Thank you. Just a couple of things I jotted down. The social worker, Ms. Gens, her involvement with the family prior to May of 2020 was on really kind of an unrelated, maybe it's a strong word to say unrelated, but it was an out-of-home placement for the oldest child, not the child that is at issue here. She really didn't have any involvement with the child at issue. It was the oldest child, and I think what I'm asking the court to do, and this is going to probably be for all of the points I raise here and even for everything I already discussed before, you know, and I know this is really probably a matter of course for you anyway, but you know, to just review the record You know, I know it's not a de novo review, but, you know, pretend that you're the trial court judge and apply the appellate standard and read the record. I think there's misstatement of facts on some of the points that Ms. Evenson has made with regard to an ongoing social worker since October. And I think I'm digressing.
Well, you know, I don't know if that's correct, but in any event, at the end of the day, what is the department supposed to do with someone who doesn't want to do anything? I suppose you could pick them up and drive them to treatment. But at some point, you know, it is a two-way street. And, again, speaking for myself and not my colleagues, you know, it seems like your client just was done. And at that point, why don't you tell us what you think the department should have done when she said, you know, I don't want to do any of this. I'm out of here. What should the department have done to get her to do the case plan?
Well, I think this is just, again, a matter of obligation, statutory obligation. And I to say what all they should have done is maybe harder for me to say than it is to just simply say they should have done more. Housing, for example, was a known issue at around the time of the permanency petition being filed. No services were offered to help with housing. And it's an obligation that they have to do more than they did. I know that's not answering your question probably the way you want me to, but I think what I said it best in the first 15 minutes was, without seeing more on their part, because if, again, reviewing the record fresh and just going through it, I don't think that there's substantial evidence of reasonable efforts that the agency was actively reaching out and trying to engage mother. What happened, I think a lot of people are involved in this were guilty of this. We thought there was going to be a plan in place at first. It started to fall apart. Everybody was trying to salvage and work on maybe a different plan. And in the meantime, nobody's working with mom to try to address some of the things that would have allowed the child to safely return home. And we can sit here and say, well, we don't know how that could have been turned out differently. And I think that's the main issue here is, we're talking about a fundamental right and due process requirements. And I think pivotal to that is, there's a reason why every statutory basis for termination of parental rights requires that reasonable efforts be made and less excuse. There's a reason for that. it's because we're dealing with significant fundamental rights. And so I wish I could say, well, here's what the magic recipe would have been. And if they would have done that, then we would know that. No, I can't say that. But again, that's not my job. They need to be able, like I said, if you look at that finding of fact, that just kind of, I think, kind of glosses over the most important timeline in this case when talking about reasonable efforts. And it's just, there should be enough evidence at the district court level to expound on that in great detail. And it's just not there. And there's a reason why it's not there, is because it wasn't offered and it wasn't presented as part of the evidence in the underlying case. So I have some other things I wrote down. They're probably not overly important, but I would just comment that there is a permanency disposition that would accommodate a co-parenting type of schedule. It's a transfer of custody. You can do parenting agreements in part of that, and that was the plan, and that's why this fell apart. The record is clear on that too. One last important point with regard to the guardian ad litem, I think the record's pretty clear that she didn't meet with mom until prompted at a hearing. And she said, Ms. Allen's never come to me. And then she met with her once after that. And that was kind of the gist of it. So I don't know that she can have a very informed opinion when she had made it up in March and then only met with mom once and never watched the parent-child relationships and so forth. Didn't reach out to the therapist, all those things. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments and briefs. The matter is submitted.